From Illinois Public Media, this is The 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. It's time for our reporter roundtable, where we talk about the news making headlines in different parts of the 21st state. Today, we're focusing on the Bloomington-Normal area and some of the surrounding communities. Joining us now are two reporters from the region. Drew Zimmerman is government reporter for The Pantograph, the daily newspaper in Bloomington-Normal. Drew, welcome to The 21st Show.
Thank you for having me.
Also with us, Eric Stock, news director at WGLT, Bloomington Normal's public media. Eric, welcome back to the show to you. And Drew, I'm going to start with you. Bloomington city officials have approved a new fee targeting, how do I put this, certain types of massage businesses. There was a scandal involving some of these types of establishment last year in Springfield. What can you tell us about what Bloomington is trying to do with its ordinance?
This is a topic that the city of Bloomington's administrative staff has been working on for a couple of years now. And the idea was to try and establish some type of a regulatory framework and fee structure that would help to more easily identify these businesses that may be offering massage services that are illegal in nature. I mean, I'm trying to be as sensitive about this as I can, but it's just trying to just ensure that only proper licensed massage establishments are operating within Bloomington and there's no storefront that may be offering illegal services and be posing as similar businesses. But the ordinance, as it initially was introduced back in June, would establish a fee structure where there would be a $100 application fee and a $250 annual fee for these businesses to maintain operations. But a lot of these licensed massage therapists were very taken aback by this and were upset that they were not brought to the drawing board when this ordinance was being drafted. So there was a lot of outcry from them, and so the city decided to consult with some of these business owners and get their input. And what ended up happening was that the ordinance was reintroduced a month later, eliminating that $250 annual fee. And there would still be certain application requirements in that there would be background checks on any listed applicants or managers of these businesses and regular inspection of these premises or regular inspection of the premises, but certain outdated requirements, application requirements like the height, weight, and the physical description of applicants, stuff like that was removed. Sole proprietors were gained certain exemptions because they do have certain regulations under state statute. So that ultimately did get passed by the city of Bloomington. And I would be kind of remiss if I didn't also just briefly mention a series of investigative stories done by David Heath, who's part of our parent company, Lee Enterprises Public Service Journalism team, who really took this topic and looked at the broad scope of it and how the pursuit of justice is often pretty minimal in these cases and how law enforcement often targets the victims rather than the guilty parties at hand. So I just wanted to just kind of highlight that series, which should be available on all of the Enterprises online publication.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, you're. That's an interesting point about targeting the victims, if you will, who are often subject of human trafficking, as opposed to the people who are paying for those services, the Johns, I guess, in the old fashioned way of saying it. All right. Well, an interesting story, and we'll, I'm sure, continue to see that play out over time. Eric Stock from WGLT, let me bring you into the conversation now, and I guess sticking still sort of in the realm of criminal justice. Am I saying this right? Reditus Labs CEO Aaron Rossi has been sentenced for healthcare and wire fraud. Can you remind us who he is and how we got to this point?
Yeah, and that was the second major case that he has been sentenced in, and he was not someone that a lot of people knew about, say, 5 years ago, but had a pretty sudden rise to prominence in Bloomington Normal and in Peoria, but then had a pretty sudden fall as well. So this week he got 3 years in prison for defrauding the state and public and private insurers out of hundreds of thousands of dollars. Now, Rossi is someone who had this sudden rise by taking a startup company in about 2020 He built it into a COVID testing giant in a very short amount of time at the start of the pandemic. This was crucial because at the time, you recall, there were not a lot of providers that were able to provide COVID tests to the community. He got a big state contract at the time. The company made a lot of money in a very short amount of time.
Even appeared with the governor, as I remember correctly, at one public event. Yeah.
Indeed. Indeed, he was. So he has since received 5 years in prison for a fraud scheme that preceded all this. So he was already behind bars. Before he was sentenced this week, his defense had compiled more than 50 letters of support, pleading for a lighter sentence on his behalf. They included family, friends, colleagues. They alluded to his parents divorcing when he was young and how this must have been a difficult thing for him. Now, Rossi did take full responsibility at his sentencing for his actions. He apologized. I'm not sure if it really helped his case. The judge, Sarah Darrow, had said that, parents divorcing does not really meet the bar for a mitigating factor. And she called this a case of hubris and unlimited greed. And what he was basically doing was overbilling for Medicaid, for Medicare, individual private insurers, for the COVID tests that were being handed out and pocketing the money. And he accumulated a pretty large amount of that in a very short amount of time. And he is getting sentenced for a second time.
Yeah. Dozens of cars, luxury jets were some of the things that he acquired. Interesting how that has finally come full circle for him. All right, let me remind listeners, this is the 21st show. We're doing our reporter roundtable where we talk about stories making headlines in different parts of the state. Today, focusing on Bloomington Normal. We're talking with Eric Stock, news director at WGLT, Bloomington Normal's public media, and Drew Zimmerman, government reporter at the Pantograph newspaper. Drew, McLean County is settling a lawsuit over the alleged treatment of someone who is incarcerated at the McLean County Jail. Remind us what he says happened and what the outcome of the case seems to be heading toward.
This has certainly been kind of a long time coming and a lawsuit that we've been keeping an eye on for quite a while. But at the heart of it was a 2019 incident involving a young man named Levante Rayford, who suffers from epilepsy and was on a daily regimen of anti-seizure medication that had to be administered twice a day. But he had been detained after an incident at the hospital where he had thrown something at a nurse. Those charges have since been dropped in the case. I just want to make sure that's kind of clear up front. But he was brought in, and once that happened, his mother, who was also his guardian, Latasha Rayford, had notified the jail that he is on this medication and that it needs to be taken twice a day. And she even went as far as to notify his doctor the next day to ensure that the prescription that he was on was a valid one and that he needed to be on this medication while he was detained. Unfortunately, he did not get access to that medication due to just a number of factors that are just kind of that were outlined in the suit that was filed back in 2021. He ended up having three different seizures over a 24-hour period, the third of which caused him to have a serious head injury, which he was ultimately hospitalized for. Only at that point was he able to gain access to that medication, and so his mother, Latasha, had filed a lawsuit against multiple parties, including McLean County and McLean County Sheriff's Office. Since then, there has been a settlement that's on the verge of being reached. There are still a few legal technicalities that I'm currently trying to fight through FOIA to get access to. I unfortunately do not have any details of the settlement at this time, but unfortunately, it is just kind of an issue that we've seen quite a lot, and we're hoping to highlight in an upcoming series of stories about how there are just a lot of variability just within the administration of healthcare and mental health services within county jails. And that just puts a lot of individuals at risk because jails are not and jails and the administration of healthcare within jails are not under the authority and administration of the Illinois Department of Corrections. They're under the individual counties themselves, which may have different populations, which may have different partnerships with various healthcare providers. Just a lot of different factors that determine just the variability of the degree of healthcare that you're going to be receiving. So we're hoping to paint that in a broader picture very soon. But this, with this being such an old case, I also do just kind of want to clarify that McLean County Jail has made a lot of leaps and bounds in their healthcare and mental health services since this case. They didn't have the healthcare provider, the third-party healthcare provider that they do now when this incident had occurred, and they're now probably one of the state's leading facilities in the administration of mental health services within, or as far as county jails go. They offer such a wide variety of services that they're probably leading the pack in that regard.
Yeah, fascinating. And for a variety of complicated reasons, we could do a whole show on, people with significant mental health challenges do often end up in jails. I know the Cook County Sheriff once described his the jail that he oversees as the largest mental hospital in the country, essentially, de facto. So that is another issue we will continue to follow over time. Let's talk about something completely different. Eric, coming back to you, Illinois State University Athletics says it's going to be directly paying student athletes. How is that going to work? What's behind this?
Well, this does also involve a court settlement, but one of a much different kind, a landmark settlement that involved former student athletes, and they had sued over their inability to make money off their name, image, and likeness. I'm sure we've all heard about NIL here in college athletics in the last couple of years. The argument they were making, and they succeeded in court, was that everyone else was making money off of them except for themselves. So this case not only comes with a huge cash payout from schools like ISU, but it also allows students to set up direct payments from universities. Up until now, in the last year or two, they've been using these so-called collectives that sort of bypassed administrations, athletic offices directly, but now they've taken that out of the equation. And we talked to ISU's athletics director, Jerry Beggs, on the day that the settlement took effect earlier this month, and she said it's the biggest change in the history of college sports, basically eliminating the amateur model. Now, she said it's too early to tell what impact this may have, what structural changes they'll need to make. I think a lot of athletics administrators are waiting to see what their competitors do. The challenge they have is this is private money, even with public schools. The NCAA does not require any documentation on any of this, so it's all voluntary. No one's going to volunteer what they're paying athletes. So it's very much a gray area and uncharted territory for all of these schools. But they all do know that they're going to need to attract more donors, more sponsors, and they'll need to do this to keep the kind of athletes that they'll need to compete with other schools in the Missouri Valley Conference. And of course, ISU is in the same boat with schools across the country trying to figure out how to navigate this.
Yeah, there's like an arms race element, right? I understand. My understanding is ISU was going to wait a bit, but like they feel like they can't afford to, maybe?
I think that's probably the case, but they feel that they're better off than at least a number of the schools in the Missouri Valley. ISU has done very well if you look at the entire spectrum of college athletics in comparison to their competitors. They've won the overall conference championship more than they haven't in the last 7 to 8 years. But of course, men's basketball and football seems to be driving a lot of the conversation. Women's basketball as well. They are driving a lot of the need for additional revenue for their sports programs.
All right, just maybe about a minute left, Eric, maybe even a little less. Bloomington-based State Farm is significantly increasing rates on homeowners insurance. This has prompted pushback from Governor Pritzker. What did he have to say about that, and how is State Farm responding? Again, briefly, please.
Yeah, it's pretty rare for an elected official to come out against a business that's operating in their state, but the governor had made the claim that State Farm is running up its rates for homeowners here in Illinois to pay for insurance claims in other states. The State Farm has responded to say that that's patently false. The governor has since said that he wants the state legislature to come back and find ways to further regulate and prevent these kind of increases from happening. And Illinois is one of many states that does not have regulatory control over rates. A lot of states do. California does, in fact. And State Farm just had a battle with the state of California after they had massive damage claims from the wildfires there.
Mm. Well, this is a subject we will continue to discuss on the show. Eric Stock with WGLT, Drew Zimmerman with the Pantograph, thanks so much for being with us and sharing your reporting with us today on the 21st show.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And on that note, I mentioned this is a subject we plan to continue, and we plan to actually do so next Friday on the program. Part of that reason for that is we're considering taking a break from our sort of Friday Week in Review format. Instead of doing local and political roundups every Friday, we may instead have the kind of segments you hear every other day on the 21st show. There's so much happening in Illinois. We think this is an opportunity to actually go more in-depth on some of those stories. Let us know what you think. You can email us anytime, talk@21stshow.org. talk@21stshow.org. More to come after a break. This is the 21st Show.
Support for the 21st Show comes from listeners like you and the Des Moines Arts Center, located in Iowa's capital city, featuring works by regional, national, and international artists of the 20th and 21st centuries. Details are at DesMoinesArtsCenter.org.